Hello, inhabitants of the pop culture deep state. Welcome to Big Mouth, the self-appointed undemocratic cabal that decides what's popular and what isn't. Well, let's be honest, things would be a lot better if we did. I'm Andrew Harrison, and here with me, as ever, it's Sean Pattenden, the level-headed Condoleezza Rice to my inept George W. Bush. Hello, Sean. How you doing?
I'm all right, thank you, Andrew Harrison.
The Alan Partridge trailer went up this week. Did you enjoy it?
Certainly did. I've watched it a few times, embarrassingly enough. It's wonderful,
all,
isn't it?
All 44 seconds of Alan. Yes. And Alan in a strange land. Because he's in like the kind of the one show now, isn't he, it appears?
Yes, he's certainly out of his comfort zone, isn't he? The eyes, you can see it in the eyes, desperation, it's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful, I want to watch it now.
It's dead exciting. Yes. It looks like he's going to have actual money spent on his show for a change as well. who are our guests this week, Sean?
Well, funny you should mention that. Luke Turner is the co-founder of beloved difficult music website, The Quietus, which flies the freak flag high, with splendid writing about bands for whom it wasn't about the Beatles and the Stones, it was about the Fall, Can, Throbbing Gristle, personal favourite, and The Last Poets. Luke, however, has not contributed much to The Quietus lately. Because he's been working on his remarkable new book, Out of the Woods, a meditation on masculinity, sexuality, mental health, faith and sturdy hiking boots and a good pat lunch. It's out now. It's very, very good. And we'll be talking about it later. Hello, Luke. Welcome back to Big Mouth.
Hello.
Have you missed being in the mud and grime of music, swapping it for the mud and grime of the woods?
Yeah, I mean, somewhat annoyingly, it didn't really go away that much, just because the sort of the constant sort of plugging holes in the great ship of Quietus and, you know, burning the furniture to keep the boilers going kind of still took up a lot of time, really. So it hasn't really ended, but the two things kind of fit together quite nicely, I think. Mm-hmm. As some of the artists we write about obviously appear in the book a lot, so it was a complimentary process.
Yeah, so I was imagining you in a sort of mud hut in the forest, saying, "No, stop emailing me, go away."
No, I'm not into that whole sort of like separation of the modern world from nature. I sort of wander around the forest doing my emails.
A lot of people can't work with music on, myself included, and some can't work without it. Is it possible to write a book too? The sort of music Quietus.
It is, yeah. That's the great advantage of stuff that doesn't have words or tunes. it's great to write to. There's a particular artist called Richard Skelton who makes electronic and sometimes acoustic music based around landscape, and there's lots of drones, and I listened to that constantly when writing, and it was amazing. Yeah. He's brilliant for all forms of writing and creative thought as
Must
well.
Must do a drones playlist for people who need to write.
The Drones Club. We did Nick Clegg's podcast last year, and we've discovered that the Turkish writer Elif Shafak writes her thoughtful feminist novels to deafening death metal.
Really?
Like, brilliant. She writes Slayer and things that make Slayer sound like Mel and Kim. And she writes these novels of thought and experience.
She sounds great.
She's great.
We ought to interview her on The Quietus, I think. That'll
actually, you know what? She's right up your street.
Yeah.
We'll hook you up. There you go.
Luke, were you intrigued by the Alan Partridge trailer?
I thought it was amazing. Yeah. Just the like you say, he's so anxious, and the way he's just sort of sticking his tongue between his teeth and I was calling for water, and it was so good. I think it's going to be wonderful. I thought the Scissored Isle thing that he did the other year was pretty much the best Partridge there's been, and could this be even better? I think he just gets better and better with age.
Right. I love the bit where he sees his old geography teacher in the street and storms out of the car, and you see him berating him silently through the window of the car. So that was ultimate Partridge. Also joining us this week is Big Mouth regular Mark Hooper, a veteran of The Face and Arena magazine, a regular writer for The Guardian, now selling the wild seas of freelance life. Hello, Mark, how are you doing?
Hi, very good, thanks.
Can you write with music on?
Yeah, weirdly, I started doing that with Tangerine Dream after Bandersnatch.
Oh, really?
I chose that. That was my option when I was watching it. And I thought, that's actually really, it's really good. It's got that kind of cyclical thing where it's actually quite good. But it also kind of sends you to sleep as well, which isn't ideal.
Mm. A few of the film writers at Empire said they actually had actual film soundtracks on while they write. And I don't know if that's a good idea or not, you know, because you're trying to exercise critical distance. And then there's Hans Zimmer going, "This is amazing!" You know. Good idea about it? I don't know. What are you excited for, as they say, the young people today, for the Alan Partridge bit?
Yeah, I thought it was amazing that, you know, the awkwardness in like 40 seconds, how long it was. And I love the co-host completely dismisses him straight away and just like didn't know what he'd done before and thought his radio show was a TV show. So, yeah, it's brilliant. You can see, already see like the sort of tension within, you know, just a few seconds. Brilliant, yeah.
On this week's show, as well as Luke's book, or Luke's book, depending on where you live, we're going to be looking at the remake of wartime submarine classic Das Boot that's just started on Sky and now TV. Yes, it's a reboot. Actually, no, it's not. It's a sequel. Does it maintain the grit and rigour of the original, and is it seaworthy? Also, David Bowie, Finding Fame. The last of Frances Wheatley's three Dame documentaries went out on BBC Two last week. It's still on the iPlayer. Does it bring us something new about Bowie's early, less than successful years? And what are we going to do now that we are experiencing Dame closure? And we've got the return, after an eight-year break, of bleak and austere Scouse Scots Bulgarian electropop quartet Ladytron. We're going to get to it all after this reminder from Sian.
Do not forget, you can get every episode of Big Mouth a day early if you sign up to support the podcast on Patreon, the crowdfunding platform. Pledge us the price of a pint each month, a mere £5. However, I think that I have not paid less than £5 for a pint of beer in a very long time.
Well, you will move in these sophisticated circles, Sian.
Even Wetherspoons will charge you £5. We'll send you the episode on the Friday rather than the Saturday, which is really good. So you can travel home on a Friday with finely milled pop chat in your ear. And you'll get the famous extra bit for Patreon backers only. At the moment, we're talking about the best and the worst people our guests have interviewed. And just warning you, Luke and Mark, last week we had tales of Lou Reed, Prince Public Enemy from Will Hodgkinson and Eamon Ford. So they're going to take some beating. Up your game, please. Just search Patreon Big Mouth or go to the Big Mouth Facebook page to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
I don't know where this £5 a pint Witherspoons is. Is it the Queen's Witherspoons in Buckingham Palace? Probably.
I don't think so, Andrew.
I don't. One will have a pint. Anyway, let's start off with Das Boot on Sky Atlantic and Now TV. The original 1981 movie starring Jürgen Prochnow and Herbert Grönemeyer is rightly seen as among the greatest German movies and the greatest war movies ever made. It tells the unbearably tense and claustrophobic tale of the U-boat U-96 on patrol during the Battle of the Atlantic in 1941. And there are a few more powerful stories of men under pressure. Literal pressure. They're at the bottom of the sea. And hopeless causes. This new sequel is a German-made eight-part miniseries. Is it a worthy companion to the original? Well, ordinarily we'd play the trailer, but it's all in German. So here's Klaus Doldinger's classic theme from Das Ursprüngliche Boot. That's the original boat. Von Boatgesicht. You have no idea how hard it was not to play the techno version. Emergency. I was very amused, by the way, when it starts on Sky, the pre-programme warning goes, this programme contains strong language and drug use. And the Nazis as well. It contains the Nazis. The Nazis were actually worse than strong language. That's what I think, anyway.
And drug use, I suppose.
So the new Das Boot from Austrian director Andreas Proschkasa, I think. Mark Hooper, you're actually from a military family. Did you enjoy the original boot?
Being locked up in a small confined space.
Absolutely. Did you enjoy the original boot?
My dad was in the Marines. He was in the Navy. So, never been on a submarine. No. Apart from one.
He's in the Navy. Well, you sail the seven seas and live a life of ease.
Yeah, but we were on the land. Land bit of the Navy is a bit confusing.
Did you enjoy Das original boot?
I did. You know what? I've got this really vivid memory of staying up late and watching. It must have been the film version because it was all in one night.
Yeah.
But I think the original was 81. I was nine, so it must have been a rerun. I'm sure they showed it.
I think
a few
it was re-released into cinemas and
but on TV. I remember seeing it on TV.
Late 80s.
And everyone going to school and discussing it. But yeah, I loved it. And it's kind of, and obviously there's the TV serialised version, which is much longer, than there's a very long film as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of a big part of my life, I think. I really loved it. And I really like this, but there's a lot more of the action's moved to dry land now as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there's almost like two threads going on, which it kind of says a lot to us about kind of audience, I think, because I don't think we'd be able to survive eight episodes with people
stuck in a tube with 20 Germans.
And
like going to bear games.
That's what made the original so good, but it's quite nice they've kept that tension, but
yeah,
with people outside of a boat as well.
Yeah. It was the original was one of the first to kind of bring in something into the movies that actually those of us who grew up with war comics were well used to. The idea of the good German or the ones struggling with the war.
I think it's Achtung.
But you're like, Schnell. Yeah, the ones like, why we fight this useless war, the madman Hitler will destroy us, all that kind of thing. It was a kind of an original thing to say on TV.
Yeah.
Did you find this new version as sort of powerful as the first?
I think it's probably slightly less subtly done. I mean, I think it was, you know, in a way, as you say, it was, you know, there was a bit of a revelation then to see ordinary Germans who weren't Nazis moaning about Nazis. yeah. and in a confined space where they can't really keep their secrets to themselves.
Yeah.
Whereas this, you know, there's a guy who's, you know, without giving too much plot away, he's obviously working with the resistance in some way and looking mm-hmm. to defect, and he gets put on the boat slightly against his will because he has to fill in for somebody who's been injured. And so it's almost like he's been slightly shoehorned there. And I think you probably don't really need somebody who's obviously anti-Nazi when, you know, we already know there were lots of Germans who were in active service who weren't Nazis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but, you know, I guess it adds to the sort of the dramatic tension.
What I liked about it was that a lot of the familiar scenes are echoed. You see, like, the fact that they all go out to a brothel the night before they sail, those scenes of the U-boat pens, the boat sailing out. And for once, it makes sense that scenes are repeated because thousands of men underwent exactly that same routine over and over again. And there's a great framing sequence where you see another U-boat. This is not much of a spoiler. It's all done and dusted in a few minutes. You see another U-boat destroyed and you watch the men who know they're going to die. Mm. And you kind of think, this is it. It's cyclical. It's just going to go on and on and on.
I know a good anecdote about the cyclical nature. Mm. Apparently, in the original U-boat, there was one prop which they used, like full length. Most of it was sort of filmed in a studio.
Yeah.
And the crew all turned up. It was harboured somewhere, and the crew all turned up one day and it was missing. And the producer said, "Oh, sorry, I forgot to tell you, this American wanted to borrow it to make a film. It was Raiders of the Lost Ark."
It's the same way.
Yeah. And they had to wait like 2 weeks until Steven Spielberg had finished and brought it back again.
Fantastic. Now, Luke, you were very enthusiastic for Das Boot. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I mean, I loved the original film. And I kind of was really into the new version, but then it's sort of grating on me a little bit. I think what makes the original brilliant is because the absolute mundanity of the patrolling. You know, they're just there, bored most of the time. And then they get a contact and there's moments of absolute terror where they're trying to kill or be killed. And in this one, they sort of fancied it up with a secret mission, which I think was a bit like, oh, do we have to have that? Can't we just have the... You know, I guess it's a modern plot thing, like you're saying, to keep people's attention. Mm. I actually think the onshore plot is stronger in a way. I think it's a bit more convincing. And obviously, you know, I've read that they were going, how do we introduce women into the plot of Das Boot? You know, you can't have women on a submarine, really.
They're bad luck.
And they weren't any. And I think that they've done that brilliantly, and that the onshore plot is fantastic. And it is, you know, it's really grim. It's an incredibly grim film in many places. Yeah. But I just wish, like, On the boat, they're still all a bit clean shaven and chiselled. You remember on the original, they look really gross and filthy, and it's like food hanging around everywhere, and it feels a lot more cramped and grotty. Mm. So I think it's a little bit too slick, but I'm sort of enjoying it.
The onshore plot in particular has got the great Lizzie Kaplan of Masters of Sex in it, and it's a bit like Secret Army has kind of done a crossover with Das Boot, isn't it? Because you've got the French Resistance and things like that, and also Pete Price from Mad Men as the mysterious chap. So there's clearly this is an attempt to make it relevant around the world. It's not just, you know, the original one was a huge part of Germany coming to terms with that aspect of the war that had just been suppressed for such a long time. I quite like the idea that, you know, Mark mentioned the updated bits and the fact they've brought in these additional plots. There is exactly the same sense of claustrophobia, pressure, fear, and general trappedness on land as there is in the submarine. Mm.
Yeah, I think there's shots when they're in the little La Rochelle in the French town. It's really cleverly done how there's all these faded figures in the background. You never know whether somebody might be being watched or followed. Mm. They really get that kind of sense of occupation. In that way, I thought that, and again, that's why I kind of feel that the land plot is working more than the sea one.
Sean, what did you reckon? Did you enjoy it?
I really enjoyed it, and I thought it's very brave to bring something so art house and from so many decades ago, because I barely remember. I watched it on DVD. I remember that bit, and I remember lots of men with red light, and they're all a bit sweaty, as we're saying. But apart from that, I don't really recall it that well. Just that, so to bring it out, to have the females in the plot, to make it broader, and to say, look, we're all in this together. I thought it's a brave thing to do, because it's not an immediate seller, is it? Although there is some bants, and you know, we have a bit of that. My mum used to go on what we call Hitler holidays, so I'm presuming that some of that crowd would go.
Can you expand upon that?
Not in that way. We should go and see the war dead memorial.
Oh,
she goes
right.
To Belgium. It's all right. She's not
a good
a Nazi.
Hitler holiday.
She's a good one. Yeah,
it's
fine.
It's a good Hitler holiday.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I'm presuming that the people that have the, you know, the Daily Mail story about the man repeller are the people who have those. Bookshelves don't repel men, but there's some wonderful lines, and I love that. It's saying that stiffness of the people who are locked still on land. Situations may develop which appear hopeless. And then the other one says, hopelessness is not a fact, but a state of mind to be overcome. You think, cool, that's brilliant. So in that sense, I really enjoyed it. I think it's meaty. There's a lot to it. And you sort of want to get stuck in as much as it is pretty grim.
Well, it is, you know, the...
Everyone's going to die.
Absolutely. One of the great things about the original, and I think this as well, is that it just, even taking the Second World War out of it, there's a great dramatic value in telling the story of men who are the bad guys and know they are the bad guys and know there is no hope for them. And I just find it really, really affecting, actually. We in Britain, we make sentimental war movies now that kind of shore up this national myth.
Yeah,
about bloody Dunkirk again.
That was one thing that really struck me watching it, was that why we just don't make these complicated war films. And, you know, I kind of gave Dunkirk a bit of a benefit of the doubt at the time because I quite enjoyed the film. But then you sort of go, oh, this is easily co-opted. We haven't really had a film with just like a load of... I mean, I suppose there's things like Ken Loach made The Wind That Shakes the Barley, but then it's just sort of propaganda from the other side, isn't it?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The kind of the complexity that that you get in this, or Downfall or what have you, is just brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, you cannot imagine a British studio being able to make a film about, say, the bombing of Dresden. And to look at it in an adult way.
But that'd be an amazing film.
It would be an amazing film, but you would never get anywhere near a green light because you'd be torn to shreds by the press before you'd even, you know, got a script in. You know, it's like we've been, you know, because we won the war, we've been infantilized by it. And of course, it's all. And he's back to Brexit again. Shut up, Andrew. Anyway,
right. Every time I come on, Andrew.
And, but if you want to be stuck in a confined space talking about Nazis, we do have another podcast called Romaniac.
Okay, let's step away from the conning tower. It's time for some music chosen by one of our guests, Mark Hooper. What is your editor's recommendation?
This is a Billie Eilish, Bury a Friend. Who's someone I must confess, she's kind of passed me by. She's, you know, she's almost like the new Lord. She's become this sort of teen sensation, sort of genius performer and artist. And the thing that really interests me is this is her first hit. She's been going for, I mean, she's ridiculously young. I think she's 17 now. She's been going since she was 14. But she's had, like, she hasn't had a hit in the old money sense. But she hasn't, you know, I think her first track was like number 90 in the US charts and 70 something in the UK, but it's had 200 odd million plays on Spotify. So she's got this amazing following and she's a massive global star, but this is the first time she's had a top 10 hit. Just this week it's charted.
Crikey.
And yeah, I just think it's amazing. But the thing that really interested me, Ocean Eyes was the debut single, which one remade her and went viral. Didn't really, you know, it just seemed like sort of, it's obviously well written, but it's a nice kind of teen ballad, and I'm kind of one of those people who gets a bit cynical about the charts these days. But this is just, it really stopped me in my tracks, and it's a very stop-start record. The production it reminded me more than anything of Tricky, like Aftermath, the way that song, when you first heard that, you're like, where's this coming from? And it's like, came from nowhere, stop-start all the way through. But it's really sinister, it's got this eerie mood to it, but it's also really funny. There's little funny bits in it. And,
okay.
Yeah, I've just become hooked.
Let's give it a listen. Billie Eilish and Bury a Friend.
Billie. What do you want from me? Why don't you run from me? What are you wondering? What do you know? Why aren't you scared of me? Why do you care for me? When we all fall asleep, where do we go? Come here.
Say it, spit it out. What is it exactly? Your pain is the
amount. Now, it's fair to say our guest Luke Turner's new book, Out of the Woods, is not a conventional sell in the bookstore. If you're going to read one book about how a man struggles with his sense of self, his bisexuality and his religious faith through the medium of walks deep into Epping Forest and confrontations with eternal, unforgiving nature, then this is the one. It's intensely honest, it's original, it's evocative, it's occasionally very funny, and Luke writes about it is sometimes impossible to resist the temptation of, quotes, a knee trembler under a hornbeam. Hornbeam being, of course, the most erotically named tree in the forest. It's a brilliant read. I'm going to talk about it after this song. We asked Luke to choose one that summed up the experience of writing the book. What is it and why?
It's Life is Golden by Suede from their last album, The Blue Hour. It was quite amazing after finishing the book, and then I got the new Suede record, and I was like, wow, there's a lot of the themes are quite similar about kind of dodgy laybys and the sense of a lost self and a lost child within a landscape, and then a bit of optimism, which this song does. I think it's one of the best Suede songs in years.
I think Brett thinks it's the best song he's ever written as well, doesn't he?
It's really up there.
I love it. It's fantastic. Let's have a listen.
From on the cover of the book as well, haven't you?
I have, yeah.
Yes, there you go. The book trade. Back scratching. There we go.
The same blood runs through your veins. Same strange way of talking.
Luke back in Ongar. It's a very powerful read. And Ongar's in Epping Forest. Come on, it all fits.
It's brilliant.
It's a fantastic read. It clearly took a lot of courage to write this. I mean, we go from thinking about the forest as a place where you can kind of deal with your troubles with relationships, and then your sexuality, and then digging deeper and deeper and deeper. It's not Countryfile, is it? I mean, where did you get the kind of courage to write this?
I think I just felt I had to, really. I don't know, I think it's the good Methodist upbringing. You have to be honest, don't you? You know, tell the truth. And I'd actually written an article for The Quietus about abuse after that idiot Milo, the alt-right made a lol about abusive experiences. And I wrote that piece for The Quietus, and then I got this amazing response, and I had a load of really kind and kind of open emails and contact from people who'd been through similar things. And I kind of thought, as I was going through all this stuff about relationship, I thought the issue is actually these deeper things that nobody talks about. So I've got to put it in. And it just sort of worked, really. It just kept coming out, no pun intended, when I was writing the book. And the fact that the forest wasn't working as it was supposed to, as this sort of nature cure. So I thought, once you put a bit in, you might as well go the whole length.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you're right, as it were, the whole the great thing about it is it completely inverts that sort of Sunday newspaper country column, questing well through the plashy fen, all that sort of trite rubbish, and it's like you are finding piles of rubbish and weird people in the woods, and it's not this kind of healing balm. And we do we meet a few of your musical heroes, as you mentioned, Cozy Fanny Tutti and Ian Johnston, who was part of the Coil world. Were they aware of what you were going through? Were we talking about the book as you were writing it with them?
It was odd that the kind of throbbing gristle and the related things kept appearing in the story, partly because Genesis Peorage and my dad went to the same primary school by the edge of the forest, and my dad became a Methodist minister, Neil Megson became Genesis Peorage, very divergent paths.
Covered the spread there.
But they had both had the forest as this sort of massive influence on them as a young age. So it kind of started from there, but then, knowing Cozy a bit and interviewing her a lot, and then discovering she did, porn mag shoots in the forest in the 70s, and it just kept recurring in the story. So I was talking to Cozy a bit about it, and I interviewed her for it. I interviewed Genesis for it, who's possibly talked a lot of untruths, as is possibly the porridge way. And so that just was, again, it was nothing was sort of shoehorned in it. It was just all these things that were in my life and I was interested in that sort of made sense to put into the location.
Yeah. I mean, as the book progresses, the forest starts to genuinely frighten you as a place where, it's not this kind of childhood renewal place. It's a place with, sex and death and brushes with suicide and brushes with some really dangerous people and thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what forests are. I think there's this sort of recent nature industrial complex of twee woodcuts and so on is a very modern invention, probably for the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, obviously, it has its roots in a romantic period and so on. But I think for the whole of human existence up until the modern period, forests were terrifying places and magical places and erotic places. If you're living in a house, a little squalid house in the country, like most were, with your granny in the same room and probably some pigs to keep you warm at night, you're not going to be kind of keeping the generations going in the house, are you? You're going to go and find a nice bush to do it in. And I think there's that sort of eroticisation of nature sort of been missing, and the fact that it is terrifying. Epping Forest is this very, very spooky place, particularly because the trees were cut in such a way that they would sprout in all these strange and unusual forms, the pollards.
Yeah, that's one of the crazy things that comes out of the book, is that it's not actually a natural forest at all. It's been warped by man in all kinds of ways, so deep we don't even understand them anymore.
Yeah, I mean, there's no forest in England that's natural. It's all managed woodland in one way or another. And I think if we get back to an idea of understanding that we were always part of these landscapes and working with them by cutting them, which is counterintuitive, then it kind of has a wider environmental awareness impact. We need to get people into woods and thinking of ourselves as part of it, rather than sort of this separate fetishized twee landscape.
Yeah, I mean, a huge theme of the book is the kind of the magnetism of sex and sexuality, and the the kind of self-generating doubts and identity ideas that come from that. In some ways, the forest is the very last place you should go to deal with that, isn't it? You're surrounded by mindless nature and beetles having sex on a plank in front of you, all that kind of thing. You should have gone to a shopping centre. You should have gone to a car park or something like that. That would be very suede.
Yeah,
Yeah, stand in the car park.
Exactly. Yeah.
The next book. I stood in the car park.
Yeah.
There's a fascinating bit where you visit the Grunwald in Berlin, which is an entirely artificial forest made from the ruins of wartime Berlin. And they're actually... there are ground up dead people in it. Although, of course, there are ground up dead people in every forest. That's what makes forests. But the idea that you're in a completely artificial, completely man-made thing that's buried on top of the greatest nightmare of recent history is affecting.
That was really strange, that trip. I was there for a music festival and I'd kind of been in Berghain the night before and then decided to get up, or not really go to bed, but go straight to the forest and then had this sort of very intensely erotic experience in the nudist bathing lake. It was all got very Euro trash, as I write about in the book. And then walked up this, what I thought was a beautiful hill, and it turned out to be anything but, really. It just contained Berlin, basically.
All the mashed up bits. You mentioned this kind of the strain of, twee country writing. There is a bit of a resurgence in non-twee country writing, hasn't there, though? I mean, I think, you know, you're quite associated with Caught by the River, and they sort of look about it in a bit more of an unsentimental manner. You know, Mel Harrison writes about it in a non-sentimental way. Why is the country back?
I don't know. I think a lot of it's to do with most of us live in cities now, so we find it very interesting to think about what goes on beyond the borders. And I know a lot of people live in the countryside who think all this writing is ridiculous and we should all stop, because that's just where we live. It is full of sex and death and, whatever, you know.
But they read books about people having sex in the city and they think it's amazing and exciting and, look, they can get a burger at 2 o'clock in the morning, the most exciting thing in the world. Ooh, Deliveroo, you know. It's, so whatever. You're now touring the book. Is it easier to talk about this really personal stuff in front of, a reading group in Wanstead kind of thing than you thought? Maybe it was earlier on.
Yeah, I that's a good question. I haven't really thought about it. I don't really... I mean, I've written it and it's out there, so I don't really... doesn't really bother me. It's quite interesting seeing the impact it has on people, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I've quite enjoyed it. I'm going to be doing some with a fellow who I met in the forest who makes sort of recordings of the forest and messes them up. So we're going to be doing some actual gigs together as well. Sort of, I'm on. It's not me dealing with my frustrated pop star. Honest.
I think you should be on Country File talking to John Craven about a knee tremble under a hornbeam. I think that would really expand the audience.
To be honest, that would fulfil a long-standing ambition to go on Country File. I love that programme.
Fantastic. Well, it's not a spoiler to say that by the end you are kind of able to see the wood for the trees. Do you think you are a different person from having written the book?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, though, I don't want to say, it was cathartic and a great experience of self-discovery. It really was. which is, it's both kind of irritating because can seem quite smug, but it's also great because I was a bit of a mess before. So it has had a positive impact.
Well, we exhort all readers to read out the words by Luke Turner. It's a jolly good read.
Yes. Moving on. If you're not watching David Bowie Finding Fame on BBC Two last Saturday, you're not really a big mouth kind of person, are you? It's the final part of Francis Whateley's Accidental Trilogy. After 5 years and the last 5 years, it goes back to the Dame's early, not very successful years as an itinerant mod and tousle-haired folk pixie. Did we enjoy it and did we discover new things? Because that's the point. Here's perhaps the emblematic track of Bowie, the Anthony Newley years. This is Love You Till Tuesday.
Just look through your window. Look who sits outside. Little me is waiting, standing through the night. When you walk out through your door, I'll wave my flag and shout, beautiful baby, my burning desire started on Sunday. Give me your heart and I'll love you till Tuesday. Da 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 da.
Don't be afraid, it's only me hoping for a little romance. Not annoying at all, is it? Mark Hooper, I'm sure you enjoyed that song. You're a Dame aficionado too. Did you enjoy this latest and probably last Bowie BBC doc?
I found it sort of fascinating and frustrating in equal measure, really. I mean, I think it's really the most fascinating period because there's so little known about it in some way. I mean, it's not in the public consciousness in the way that the other two films were and deal with things we were familiar with, and even the revelations, it was kind of framed around something we were aware of. And I think the thing that really struck me is, like, you know, he was almost a decade as a failed musician convinced he was going to be a star, and seemingly everyone around him was convinced he was going to be a star apart from the BBC. But he was, you know, he was the way he would constantly keep going at it, and basically, and, you know, for a long time he was a one hit wonder, because Space Oddity comes in the middle of that, and then he doesn't have a hit. And the thing I hadn't really realised was the chronology of how albums which are now considered classics were flops at the time, you know. I mean, like Hunky Dory, I wasn't sure about it. That's not right. I looked up on Wikipedia and said number three, and it said it, you know, it didn't chart, but it was actually number three after Ziggy Stardust, because then it went back into the charts again. They released singles from Hunky Dory again, and then Changes came out, obviously, because he was trying to capitalise on his success and get people into his older records and things like that. So, yeah, I find it amazing, and just the way he... I mean, it's a kind of a cliche to talk about Bowie and, you know, being a sort of pop chameleon and all that stuff, but he was literally just trying to find something that worked. And, one week he'd be Anthony Newley, the next week he'd be telling everyone they would get into Velvet Underground, the next week it was The Laughing Gnome. You know, he's just desperate to have a hit, and however he could do it, just to get his name out there. And, yeah, I found it amazing, very sort of driven and quite selfish in many ways. But that's what I find fascinating about him. He's, you know, everyone talks about him being really... I know Jeff McCormack a little bit, who crops up in this show. We've got a mutual friend, and I went on a stag do with him and spent the evening. He's an amazing guy and talks exactly like Bowie, really charming. And he obviously loves him. They're oldest friends. But he said, you know, he'll just drop you. You know, I think, you know, Jeff was slightly different. I think they kind of stayed in contact most of the time. But, you know, he'd pick people up, and they were totally aware that, you know, he'd pick a guitarist because he's perfect for them. You become famous, and then he'll drop you, and like, okay, next, you know, and the people just seem to accept that.
Luke, it promised things we didn't previously know or had seen, and there are interviews with former girlfriends Dana Gillespie and Hermione Farthingale. Did you find things that you didn't know?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that having Hermione in there was great. Mm. That sort of real sense of how heartbroken he was and how that fed the music was wonderful. I thought there's an amazing bit, which I won't give away, but if you ever want to know what the inspiration, what he ripped off for The Laughing Gnome, bit is just wonderful.
It's just brilliant.
I love that. And the stuff like, you know, Woody Woodman's ego, and basically, like, you know, the last Ziggy gig, I've just been sacked on stage. Like, you know, he did just drop that band without telling them. And so I kind of enjoyed it. It wasn't as good as the kind of the last 5 years one, which I thought was just so moving and powerful, but it was still really good. And, you know, you kind of realise how dreadful a lot of that stuff. I mean, it was really bad. Mm. You know, there's no kind of like, oh, actually, in retrospect, it was brilliant. I mean, you can hear, it was fascinating because you can hear little snippets of what he became. Yes. You know, oh, there's a bit there that comes out later. But I think, there's a great bit where Bowie's talking about he's reacting against the tyranny of the mainstream. And I was just like, obviously, quiet as head on, brilliant. I wish more artists did that today. And I wish the music business still gave somebody a decade to just keep failing and then let them, let them come back. How many people who could have been brilliant have we lost since by the short-termism and the obsession with youth that
but
we have
But the funny
now?
Thing is, of course, you see him, he may have been reacting against the zeitgeist like a chameleon, mate, in later years, but in this period, he's doing as utmost of his commercial as he possibly can.
Yeah, that's true.
Chasing
yeah.
every trend he can lay his hand. He was never a particularly convincing, kind of hippie princeling with his... Although that was a particularly amazing haircut, I thought. The ringlets was a particularly good Bowie haircut, but the music was particularly bad. He could never really carry that one off. But, you know, he couldn't see a bandwagon without flinging himself at it and actually having to have a saxophone and everything. Yeah. So I found that really endearing because I'm a big fan of hard work and much prefer hard work to inspiration.
What did you think of it overall, Andrew? The stylized production we're familiar with now, lots of sound bridges and him, you know, that typewritten stuff at the beginning as it's talking about what he's saying, it's following the audio.
As somebody who frequently ends up on a Channel 5 talking head thing about the best, worst records ever made, I was in awe of and envious of the time work, resources and access that this show... This is what a rock documentary ought to be like. They got... You know, Francis Whitney got all of the interesting people who were still alive, and a good few of the dead ones as well, because Dudgeon's in there, beyond the grave, and knits it all together very in a manner that tells a story without being too narrative to the fore. I mean, it had to me a kind of a bit of a dreamlike quality, in that it jumps around time quite a lot. It's not hot on chronology. It's very hot on themes and you know the kind of the emotional trajectory of the whole thing. But, you know, I love those, you know, old distress pictures of, you know, Bowie age six, you know, flying across the screen while the disembodied vocal of Space Oddity says something about that little picture of Bowie age six. Mm. And the picture of Bowie age six says something about Space Oddity. I love all that, you know. It's filmmaking. It's the school of the orb filmmaking, isn't it? Just overlay a whole load of samples. I did think that the former girlfriend interviews were a tiny bit underwhelming in mm-hmm. that you didn't feel that there's a massive kind of you know, revelation going on here. But one thing I did spot, which really I thought was an absolute insight into David Bowie, is when Hermione Farthingale and Bowie break up, she goes and joins a musical called Song of Norway, and in the last year of his life, Bowie appears in a T-shirt with yep. Song of Norway on it. Yep. Oh, and nobody wow. yes. Nobody knew video. Why. I didn't know why.
Oh, well, they worked it out.
And then finally, oh, my God. You know, that's Bowie using the medium of his fame to just send a little message to Hermione, a letter to Hermione. Hello, I remember you. I miss you. That, I thought, was just gorgeous and really lovely. But then there's loads of really, really funny bits as well. I mean, the Laughing Gnome bit, as Luke points out, I won't spoil that one, but it is brilliant. And Bowie's old band, the Riot Squad, saying they used to play Wait for Man as a homosexual conga dance. And I'm not entirely sure what a homosexual conga
that
dance
should have caught on, I feel.
Yeah, and amending the lyrics to Waiting for My Man to I'm Just Waiting for a Nice Behind. Yeah. Dirty old Dane. So I think there's a good sense of humour in there. I also was completely charmed by Lindsay Kemp.
Oh, far
yeah,
show
that
character.
Was amazing. Him being in it, I thought he was just yeah. wonderful,
it
wasn't
was
he?
Really, really funny. And you just look at it, you think you are a charming individual, and it's clear that.
And he really slagged off Bowie's mime, which was very
yeah.
funny.
It was terrible. Yeah, yes. But and I think the film is very clever at dropping humour into it by showing you some of the Dame's dreadful mime. But it doesn't destroy everything else at the Dame.
See, this is where I had a few problems with the world of cliché here. Mm. It's heralded, and there's a voiceover beforehand saying it's about the icon, the true legend, the superstar. I don't want that story. Mm. I don't want that story. Mm. And I felt that it couldn't really tread the line between icon, superstar, look, he's going to be really famous, and actually he was a bit shit. It was kind of erring on both directions. I wanted it to be real, and I felt somehow too much Ziggy footage at the beginning. I don't want to see 73. I want to see him struggling. I want to see him trying to get out of the suburbs.
But that's part of the trade that a film like this has to make in order to A, to get made, and B, to attract the large, basically post-death Bowie audience.
Yes, but we're not obsessives and we know all that stuff.
Yeah, I know, but this film is not just for us, and there's so much in it that's just for us. I think it's a really good compromise between fan service, I believe they call it, and making sure Joe Public is interested. I think there's great bits in it. The BBC's rejection letter to Bowie's band, The Lower Third, it's absolutely priceless. He is of no value and he can't sing. Yeah. All this kind of stuff. I just thought, and there's bits of the recording of Toy, the unreleased album, where he revisits all those original songs from that period, where clearly Bowie's sort of looking for a bit of vindication about his shit years. Maybe they weren't that shit. Maybe they were quite good. Yeah. I just found it really... considering it's about the least interesting part of Bowie's life, I found it very interesting and enjoyable, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're still on iPlayer if you haven't seen it. We want to see it again and again and again.
I'm going to have a 9-hour, a 3-hour, 4-hour marathon of watching them all in sequence.
Das Boot and Bowie. That goes well
das
together.
Das Boot, well, you know, Christiane F., we're all over it, aren't we? It's time for another record chosen by one of our guests, Luke Turner. You're a guest. You've chosen a record. What record have you chosen?
I've chosen These New Puritans, Anti-Gravity. I love These New Puritans. I think they're probably the most interesting, strange group that's come out of the United Kingdom in the past decade. They don't ever seem to get quite as much accolade as and sort of respect as they possibly deserve. There was a brilliant feature by Jazz Monroe in the new Q magazine, or last Q magazine. I just love them. The Field of Reeds is just a masterpiece. I think it's sort of, you know, there's a lot of this contemporary classical music around that's just dull as dishwater. And I think they did something very interesting with orchestration and arrangement and different vocals. And the new album is a sort of consolidation in a way, but it's quite a romantic record and it's got lots of weird influences, and I think they're brilliant.
Okay, well, if life's bringing you down, here's These New Puritans with Anti-Gravity.
Yeah.
Finally, much as it pains me to say it, Liverpool is a bit short on proper synth bands. Yes, hello Dalek, I love you, Apollo 440 and A Flock of Seagulls. But Ladytron fit the bill good and proper, and they are back, back, back with their first album since Gravity the Seducer back in 2011, and it's called Ladytron. How are things in the world of Icy and Merciless epic sex pop? And what should you know about Ladytron that you don't yet know? Before we find out, this track is Far From Home. Well, I'm not going to lie, I am all about Ladytron. They're exactly what I want from pop music. Big electronic epics, bored and pitiless female voices, and the songs are all about how we're all doomed and the world is on fire. Luke Turner, do you like them?
I have always been a massive fan of Ladytron. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to like this, and I didn't, unfortunately.
Why did you not like it?
I just didn't. I thought it was all a bit samey. The drums are a bit, that thing with a big sound, a bit real underneath the... underneath the electronics, it just sort of boomed around a bit, and it just didn't have... There's a lot of people doing that sort of thing now, like Chromatics and audiobooks, who I think are doing it a little bit better, even more kind of icy, we're all doomed, glacial sounding. And I was just disappointed, and it's frustrating, because I think they're a wonderful, wonderful group. It just didn't quite gel for me.
I mean, they've been away for 7 years, and they did find it on the first go round kind of hard to break out of the hey, they're an electro clash band with asymmetric haircuts and buttoned up black shirts or buttoned up in a funny way. It did seem to kind of limit them a little bit. I think they've always been a lot better than that. I mean, in boringly to say it, in the musical sense, there's a lot of really strange chords going on in there, which I've found elevated them above, cheap synthesizer and bored voice, which, as we know, is a classic package of electro pop. But you found this one, you didn't think it was delivering the Ladytron that you're used to?
No, it wasn't. I kept going back to it, but it didn't quite work. And as I say, audiobooks, I think they're brilliant. They've got a song out this week called about, will you come and have a bubble bath with me? And it's in a non-erotic way. And then it's got David Wrench doing this line about she cooked a meal for the first time at 57 or something. And it's got this sort of wryness and odd creepiness that I really, really like. And then Chromatics, the Italians do it better, doing a kind of whole... Italo disco take on it with loads of sheen, just ludicrous amounts and melancholy. I just got stuck with it.
Well, as the British synth bands go, they've always had a bit more of a slice of throbbing gristling than a lot of bands. A bit more of that sort of let's look at the darkness of sex and the cruelty of love and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, which is obviously my...
Right up your street. Right up your hornbeam, yes.
Yes. But I wasn't getting it.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'd hate it when I don't like something by a group I really love. Because, the first couple of albums were stunning. I thought they were brilliant. And as you say, I loved Electro Clash. It was like one of my favourite things. And I was 21 and in London for the first time. It was marvellous. but a lot of those groups, they kind of were one single and that was it. And Ladytron, they'd had brilliant albums, 604 and the one after, I can't remember what it's called. But they're both really, really good records.
Sean, what did you think?
I'm afraid I'm a bit with Luke on this one. I was really looking forward to listening to it because I'm a bit of a hits fan with the Tron, as I even call them. And the first track's good. Yeah, it's good, great. Second track sounds a bit like... and it's sort of the law of but diminishing returns is they're all sounding very similar. It's all... Yes, as we were saying, the bored Jean-Luc Godard star sitting there in a coffee. Yeah, having a coffee and feeling...
Having a thin fag and feeling bored, yeah.
Yeah, a bit doomy. I'll go and make a record then. That sort of thing. I just felt there was nothing that kind of lifted it for me or separated it, made it apart from something else. I gave it a few goes. So I thought, I'll come back to that and I'll listen to it again. But still, I find it very difficult to hook on to it.
Is this the curse then of having realised a sound that is fully yours? Because they don't... Their sound is them. They don't sound like anybody else.
And you're not going to mistake it for anyone
else. And, 17 and Blue Jeans and Destroy Everything You Touch and Ace of Hearts, these are all fantastic singles that are songs within the context of the, you know, the cruel electronics thing.
Yes.
But once you, is it like you've built that castle and you can't get out of it?
I mean, it's a very now castle, if we're going to call it a castle. Mm. It's very Netflix. We're in Netflix, which is all doom, gloom, dystopia, doom. It's very that. I can imagine this being the soundtrack to many, many teenage dramas that are going to be on Netflix by the end of the year. Mm. I can see that. And yet there's something quite clinical. There's something just missing for me.
These are all the things I love. It's clinical. Sounds great. I actually, yes, you just made them. Me realise, actually, yeah. that the trademark voices of Mira Arroyo and Helen Marnie, mm-hmm. they're not capital S singing voices. It's not Mariah Carey and her scales.
But we don't want that.
I know. That's what makes it great. And it would be, in fact, if it was Mariah Carey and her scales, it would be dreadful.
Yes.
But I just wonder whether those voices are what makes them connect with that Netflix world and makes it fit with teen dramas, in that you can, you know, a young female audience can actually maybe see themselves in that environment. They can hear themselves in that voice.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that sense, they might go on and do enormously well.
Mm. Mark Hooper, this is a slice of electronic death pop. What did you think?
Yeah, I'm afraid I slightly agree. I felt, again, I really wanted to like this, and I really love Ladytron. And on paper, it ticks all the boxes for me, and even all the, you know, the references that are on there. But I just... left me a bit cold, and I can't really explain
to leave
why.
You cold.
I know that's the
wrong kind.
Yeah, the wrong
it makes the human
wrong kind of cold.
I mean, I was going to say, like, you know,
it's
I love
the wrong kind of
you know,
cold.
I love craftwork, and the, you know, I love craftwork cold. But yeah, I can't really explain why. And maybe you're right, Andrew, that it's because it's not a surprise anymore, because we know what Ladytron sound like, and I was expecting them to surprise me, and it's that perennial problem with bands being like, do you repeat? Yeah. What you're good at, or do you try and do something more new and experimental? But you know, the individual tracks I like, that the island, is it the island or an island? I really, really like
which
that
I think
one.
Is about Brexit.
It sounds like it's about
Brexit. Yeah,
it's
off again.
Ears pricking up. Cold, sexy electropop about Brexit.
Dive, sign me up.
Inject it into my brain. Yeah.
I think bands that have their sound are brilliant. I mean, like Suede, they nobody else sounds like Suede. Suede sound like Suede, and they always sound like Suede, and they write Suede songs, and they've kind of been, the last three albums, been doing it better and better. They kind of keep writing better about Suede. So I like groups that have that identity and don't move outside of it. I think
it's kind of unfair as well to say that they haven't changed at all, because since the sort of late noughties, I think, was it Ruben moved to Chicago? And they took on a bit more, it got a tiny bit more Nine Inch Nails-y, a tiny bit more Network Records-y, more abrasive. The drums got realer, as you said, Luke. It wasn't that sort of antiseptic Atari, Amiga, bleeps and nihilism thing that was so good part of Electro Clash. So they have changed, but this is, I think you're probably right in that this doesn't feel like a record that's 7 years since the last one. It feels like a record that's like a year after the last one. But I still love it, and you're all wrong. So there's a fantastic song called Paper Highways, which is literally about the world teetering on the edge of exploding, and it's like, to me, that's the one to get if you're up for a bit of electronic death pop. So basically we're all agreed it's brilliant and you're all wrong.
Shush. Hmm.
Anyway, on that bombshell, it's the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over their ration of schnapps when they're 5,000 metres below the surface? Luke, Skull Flower. What's happening in your closing time chatter?
Yeah, and obviously the quietus is very into a lot of kind of weird and unusual music made by the sort of people who you wouldn't necessarily want to live next door, which means that sometimes some of those people who make that music have used over the years some sort of dubious aesthetics, Daz Booty aesthetics, perhaps. And we're doing a whole series of articles exploring how far-right aesthetics and politics have kind of intermeshed within experimental music. And we did the fourth in the series this week, which is about a group called Skullflower, who are going to be playing a festival in London. And we had sort of concerns about Skullflower because the guy has a blog where he's putting pictures of airfix kits of German tank crews feeding hares to their dogs, and he's a lot of use of the Black Sun, which is the occult image that Himmler was using with the SS. And so we did a piece on Monday about, you know, Skullflower and how, you know, artists who don't necessarily sort of say, hey, I'm a Nazi, you know, kill all foreigners or whatever, but have so much going on in their aesthetic that you think, well, this is actually in the current time where the far right is on the rise, this is not acceptable. It's not 1970s anymore where, you know, Susie Susie Sue wore an SS hat on Top of the Pops, I think. Throbbing Gristle obviously used the BUF flash, as did David. You saw it in the documentary with Ziggy Stardust. And saying that there was people using these aesthetics of their time, and that's possibly a different case that one will examine. But now, is it really right to be using this imagery? And, you know, there's a group called the Order of Nine Angles, who we did a big feature on last year, who are out-and-out Nazis. And there was a guy who was kind of played with a lot of underground musicians in the UK and was released by small labels, who was basically espousing really dangerous far-right views and was connected to people who were kind of exhorting people to murder, basically, right, and things like that. So it's an ongoing series about... You know, as the quietest, and we're into underground music. We've interviewed Skullflower previously. We think it's our responsibility to now go, hang on, we need to look at this and explore when lines are being crossed.
And Skullflower have been removed from this festival,
they have,
is that right? Yeah. It's an ongoing thing, isn't it? Because, you know, Liebach make great satirical records, but... The, you know, a man on a galloping horse might think they're just a bunch of Nazis. Well,
that's exactly the point. I think Liebach are a really great illustration of this. You know, sometimes I think they push that line of, a little bit too far.
It's a little bit near the knuckle, isn't it?
Yeah, sometimes it is. I think they do that a lot less now. Mm. But they're an example of a group who are not Nazis, and avowedly not Nazis. They
keep dressing up as Nazis. It's funny, isn't it?
No, they dressed as the Yugoslav resistance.
Okay, but I withdraw that. Mark, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, funny enough, off the back of Luke's book, I've been kind of looking at trees quite a bit, because I'm working on a book as well. I should probably pick your brains a bit. But funny non-fiction, you know, I've done a lot of the things you said in the book really struck me, because it's about, you know, that sort of netherland between, you know, I grew up in the countryside, and I literally had woods on the edge of my house when I was in Exeter in Devon. Then I lived right in the middle of the countryside in Somerset, and then moved to Taunton, gradually moved out, as you do, you know, and then Muswell Hill, which is surrounded by woods, and now I'm in Tunbridge Wells, which is, you know, the ghetto. But it's totally surrounded by, you know, very, very, very genteel, but it's right on the edge of the woods again. It's quite funny. It's like some of the things you said in my book, and it's like, you know, I'm a bit of a middle-class cliche. It's like, why am I doing that? What am I trying to find? And there's a bit you said in the book where it made me think about when I lived literally woods at the back of my garden in Exeter. There were weird people going back. Me and my brother had a den, and we'd see guys. You know, we would always say, my mum would always say, "Oh, they're poachers," but you know,
poachers.
Exactly, yeah, poaching something. And it was so anyway. That's so basically, I'm writing a non-fiction book about. It's like a history book based around trees and trees where something famous happened. And
oh wow!
So you know, so like the Tolpuddle Martyrs,
yeah,
were first formed under a tree. So trade unionism was formed under a tree. So it's. It's almost like a guidebook, right? All those guidebooks are very much about, oh, this is the oldest oak and blah, blah, blah. But I don't care how old it is or what sort of tree it is. It's just if something happened there. So there are trees with, you know, there's a cannonball embedded in it from the Civil War, or the tree that Mark Boland crashed into.
We got the blame,
but it was actually the railing.
Yes, poor
the tree just ended up, the car ended up in the tree. So just things like that. So I'm researching that. So yeah, that's, yeah.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Trees are good.
Sure. Oh, this is all a bit IRL in real life, isn't it?
Mm.
This closing of time chatter. Oh, look, so is mine. online retailer, Bandcamp are going to launch a physical store, maybe made out of trees, maybe featuring Nazis. Who knows? We can tie this all in.
Let's hope not.
This month in Oakland, California. And it sounds really good. So when HMV are closing, all that sort of thing, Bandcamp are opening something real. And they're going to have exciting partnerships with local organisations, including Oakland School for the Arts, Bay Area Girls Rock Camp, which sounds absolutely tremendous, and the Transgender Law Centre. So good on Bandcamp. Can they open one near my house?
Yeah, I love Bandcamp.
By the Transgender Law Centre. I mean, so are they going to be like pressing up the records that go on Bandcamp and selling them?
It doesn't actually say that, but that's what I'm hoping to. I'll be writing to them and asking to. So maybe we can get far more of a diverse selection, and it will be somewhere that you can go to where, or you could do press to order or something like that. That'd be really good.
You could. Well, actually, Oakland is where these things are always get trialled, because I remember 15 years ago going to Starbucks's record shop. Remember when Starbucks had a record label?
Oh, I have forgotten that.
Sonic Youth did a record with them, didn't they? Which was quite bizarre.
Right.
Yeah, Paul McCartney did one with them.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
They were signing artists, and then they had a one-off record. A record shop in Oakland, which was going to be part of. This was then going to roll out.
It didn't happen. Yeah, but this Bandcamp, mate.
Well, you know, at least that's about music and not about vlogging coffee. Well, my closing time chatter is also a bit IRL as well. Stacey Abrams, the Democrat senator who responded to Donald Trump's State of the Union address, says she got ready for this major moment in history by watching old Doctor Who's on the telly. Specifically, it's better than that, old Tom Baker Doctor Who's. My people are in the corridors of power, and this is a good thing because politicians need hinterland. Politicians shouldn't just sit around reading John Stuart Mill. They should also absorb the wider culture. And I like the idea that I think she's the first black woman to give a response to say the Indian address, and I like the idea that half an hour beforehand she was looking at Tom Baker in his scarf saving planet Earth from crinoids and Wirren and Cybermen. So that's good. That shows finally phase two of the plan. My people are now in the positions of power.
She got your email then,
and we're about to take over. So that's the end of the show. Thanks to Luke Turner and Mark Cooper for coming in. Are you both going to go and enlist in the Navy Submarine Division now?
Yes, if only.
If only, yes. Remember, Luke's book, Out of the Woods, is out now and available in shops both physical and digital. Patreon backers, look out for the extra bit arriving soon. Ooh, we're going to find out the best and worst people that Mark and Luke have interviewed. It's always a revelation. Thanks to Sophie Black, producer, and co-presenter Sean Patton. Thanks to you for listening. Sean, alarm!